that, I mean, everybody that was at that from a dozen different countries have said, you don't even have to spend money on this. Just stop punishing working people and poor people in Latin America, and that could make a huge difference. And so I'm hopeful that we have now a presidential candidate that has had to work on these issues. And I think while investing in Latin America is important, I think we could also just take our foot off the gas off of punishing working people in those countries.
And you are one of the youngest a member of the Austin City Council, then a young congressman. Your sense of the role of young people today in terms of changing politics in this country?
And we just have 20 seconds.
Well, young people were the heart of the civil rights movement and the heart of the anti-war movement. And I think they're the heart of what's transforming the Democratic Party right now into something we can truly be proud of.
And 10 seconds, you went out to the uncommitted news conference to show your support for those delegates who were there to say, calling for a U.S. arms embargo against Israel.
There is really no reason for us to not use our full leverage to achieve that vision of ending bombing in Gaza. And we've got to keep fighting to protect those everyday lives.
Greg Cassar, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Congressman, Democrat from Texas, whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, labor organizer, son of Mexican immigrants. And that does it for our week of production here in Chicago during the Democratic National Convention. We've been hosted here at CAN TV, Chicago's public access television. A very special thanks to the CAN TV crew. Darius Hillman, David Tainer, Jason Bryant, Jeremy Fry, Jim Knightwright, Rocio Santos, Imani Payne, Kenny Nelson, Alan Voss, David Green.
KABU Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KABU by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kabu.fm/give. Thank you.
KABU Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar in Southeast Portland. At the annual meeting, members will have an opportunity to meet candidates running in the board election, and final votes will be cast and counted. The results of the election will be announced at the end of the meeting. Online voting is open now through the annual meeting at kabu.fm/board24. Paper ballots may also be requested. Again, that's KABU's annual meeting and board election on September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm/board24.
Support for KABU comes from KABU members and the International Travel Group. KABU Community Radio and ITG are organizing a journey to Cuba, December 14th to the 21st. It is a guided exchange of music, history, and landscapes. ITG supports KABU's mission of fostering community through diverse voices. More information at kabu.fm/Cuba.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Support for the KABU Evening News comes from KABU members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the Joint Office of Homeless Services says they made a lot of progress getting homeless county residents into housing last year.
Oregon has joined a lawsuit against a real estate software that allegedly helps property managers fix rent prices.
And in national news, a federal judge dismisses charges against two police officers charged in connection to the murder of Breonna Taylor.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, August 23rd, 2024. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. New data from the Multnomah County Joint Office of Homeless Services shows nearly 5,000 Portland residents were moved off the street and into housing last year, thanks to county dollars. They also report that 7,900 people entered a shelter last year. It's the most people that the Joint Office has served in a single year since they started in 2016. It follows years of audits and critique that the Joint Office has fallen short, both in getting people off the street swiftly and spending down their supportive housing dollars. The tax office says this year they spent down the entirety of those dollars after failing to meet that goal for the past 2 years. A recent auditor report earlier this year said the Joint Office was doing a better job creating more accurate data for its count of housing placements. The Joint Office is operated by the City of Portland and Multnomah County. The new numbers show a 28% increase in people moved homelessness into housing compared to last year. This is welcome news for an office that faced uncertainty earlier this year when some Portland leaders signaled that they didn't like how the Joint Office operated and wanted more control of their spending. A new agreement between the city and county was inked with a few concessions to Portland on how finances are managed.
Oregon is joining a federal antitrust lawsuit against a real estate software called RealPage, according to an announcement from Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum. Seven other states and the U.S. Justice Department are also suing RealPage. RealPage is a software that property managers use to manage rental communities. The lawsuit alleges that RealPage compiles information that is sensitive and non-public to train an artificial intelligence algorithm to recommend prices to landlords and property managers. Schemes to control the market economy like this may be illegal under federal antitrust law. If companies do things to restrict competition in the marketplace, in this case, keeping rents artificially high and not based on demand, that could be an antitrust violation. That means renters wouldn't be paying a fair market rate for a given community. They would have no choice but to pay a higher price. At least two neighborhoods in Oregon have been impacted by this price-fixing scheme, the lawsuit says. The area including Aloha and West Beaverton, and also Central Portland, were listed in the lawsuit specifically. That's around 54,000 units. Attorney General Rosenblum said, quote, "At a time when housing affordability is a top concern for Oregonians and for countless Americans beyond our state's borders, the issues of fairness and competition could not be more critical." She continued, quote, "RealPage's use of its AI pricing algorithm effectively acts as a hub for property managers and landlords to share confidential, competitively sensitive information and to engage in a pricing alignment scheme to avoid competition. It undermines a fair rental market and constitutes a violation of Oregon and federal antitrust laws," end quote.
A federal judge rules that Breonna Taylor's boyfriend is the legal cause of her death while dismissing charges against two former police officers. Louisville police officers Joshua Janes and Kyle Meany were charged with falsifying the warrant that led police to Breonna Taylor's door before they fatally shot her. U.S. District Judge Charles Simpson threw out those charges today, saying that Taylor's boyfriend's actions, not the bad warrant, were the legal cause of her death. Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, shot at what he believed to be intruders when police busted down Taylor's apartment door in the middle of the night. He hit an officer in the leg, and the officers opened fire with a hail of bullets across Taylor's apartment and her neighbors, killing Breonna Taylor. Taylor's family wrote in a statement, quote, "Obviously, we are devastated at the moment by the judge's ruling, which we disagree and are just trying to process everything," end quote. They say they plan to appeal the ruling. The officers, Jays and Meany, still face other charges. Jays faces a conspiracy charge, and Meany faces an accusation of making false statements to investigators. Another former officer, Brett Hankinson, is scheduled to be retired for endangering the lives of Taylor, Walker, and her neighbors when he fired into her windows. A previous trial ended in a hung jury. The retrial is scheduled for October.
Oregon Zoo visitors who bought their tickets online in the past 6 months may have had their information exposed to identity thieves. For more on what this means for customers, we go to KBOO reporter Morgan.
Oregon Zoo exposes 117,000 customers to identity theft. On June 26, Oregon Zoo found credit card information from its online ticketing service was being stolen. This sparked an internal investigation of activity going back to December of last year. The investigation found the online payment information was being redirected and stolen from a third-party vendor the zoo used. Customer credit card numbers, CVVs, expiration dates, and full names were all being compromised during the data breach. A full year of cybersecurity has been offered for affected people with TransUnion Cyber Scout service. The data breach likely came from a web skimmer, a form of phishing. A web skimmer was placed into the website by scammers through a vulnerability at the zoo's third-party vendor. Web skimmers are malware that read data put into a website's HTML forms and other interfaces. Web skimmers have a prominent role in illicit online business, with stolen data being bought and sold between different groups used in misinformation campaigns. Scammers use stolen data to buy ad space on sites like Google and social media to run fraudulent and malicious ads. In recent years, social media has had a large influx of scams and transparently illegal ads that have migrated from seedy websites and the dark web. Oregon Zoo customers who may have had their data compromised are suggested to monitor their credit history and report any unusual activity. Experts recommend avoiding using primary cards on small sites or insecure sites. They say using secure payment services such as PayPal, Cash App, or Google Pay, etc., protect against unsafe websites by never giving a seller access to your payment information.
That was KBOO reporter Morgan talking about a recent data breach at the Oregon Zoo.
A new metric from the Oregon Health Authority aims to make social and emotional treatment for young children more accessible. The Health Authority adopted the child-level social-emotional health metric, which will improve and incentivize this care for kids from birth to age 5 who are on the state's Medicaid program. Oregon is the first state in the country to adopt a measure like this. Andy Walsh with the Children's Institute in Oregon says social-emotional health is the foundation for everyone's mental health.
Building the ability to develop relationships, to experience and express emotions, to explore. All of those are components of social emotional health, and all of those are the building blocks for positive mental and physical health later in childhood and adulthood.
Walsh says the country's youth are experiencing a mental health crisis and Oregon is falling behind. A recent ranking from Mental Health America on access to care for youth placed Oregon third to last. Kara Crane served on the parent advisory group for the Oregon Pediatric Improvement Partnership, which developed this metric. She has experience with a child who needs social emotional health treatments. Crane shared her experience living in a small town, Roseburg, where wait lists for services can be years long.
If you've never experienced it, you can't imagine what it's like. So talking to people that are living it currently is a really good way to help make sure that you're not missing anything that you wouldn't know to look for because you aren't in that fight, essentially.
Walsh says the new metric will be especially impactful as the state bans suspension and expulsion from early care and education programs starting in July 2026. She says the goal of this metric is to get involved sooner with kids at risk of developing social-emotional challenges, which are often seen in child care settings and preschool.
This metric is really meant to try and reach those kids much sooner in a preventative way to start providing them with the services that we know will strengthen those skills and hopefully, theoretically, will prevent those kinds of issues moving forward.
That was Andy Walsh from Children's Institute in Oregon.
Downtown Portland will host a skateboard tournament on the waterfront this weekend. It's called the Rockstar Energy Open, and skaters from around the world, including some recent Olympians, will be there. The event is open to the public, with skating, concerts on Friday and Saturday, and vendors. Three local artists will be painting murals at the site over the weekend as well. Around 80 skaters are expected to compete in this event. It's the first one of its kind. Organizers say they wanted to tap into Portland's skate culture. The city is home to 12 local skate shops and has more than 20 skate parks. The skateboarding event will be held at Tom McCall Waterfront Park, Friday through Sunday.
Vice President Harris asks Americans to write the next chapter and accepts nomination. A former GOP congressman endorses her in order to defend democracy. And a black female delegate says it's time for the first woman mixed-race president. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks. We're live from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. We're tracking the 2024 election process.
In many ways, Donald Trump is an unserious man. But the consequences of putting Donald Trump back in the White House are extremely serious.
Kamala Harris used her nomination acceptance to lay out a vision of genuine American freedom, but to also call out former President Donald Trump as a threat to it. The vice president, still little known by many viewers, sketched her early life and time as a prosecutor, motivated, she said, by a desire to protect the innocent. But her most passionate words were aimed at what she called Trump's authoritarian ambitions, made more dangerous by the lack of guardrails in a second term. The convention featured several Republicans who turned against Trump for similar reasons. Like many, former GOP Illinois Representative Adam Kinzinger spoke about the January 6th insurrection. He said he's endorsing Harris to defend truth and decency.
And I want to let my fellow Republicans in on the secret. The Democrats are as patriotic as us.
Kinzinger described Trump as a threat to American democracy, who was suffocating the soul of the Republican Party. While the convention was happening, Trump visited the southern border of Cochise County, Arizona. He teased an expected endorsement by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was also in the state. Trump said the endorsement would be a great honor.
I can't say that, but I know we're in the same state, so we're not very far away, but I can't tell you that yet. No plans have been made at this moment.
In her speech, Harris talked about the war in Gaza, a painful issue mostly ignored by other speakers. She reaffirmed Israel's right to defend itself from terrorist attacks, but she also called for a ceasefire to end the terrible suffering of civilians and so the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination. The Secretary of New Mexico's Democratic Party, Isaac Dakota Casados, says he trusts a Harris presidency to make peace.
When we have innocent individuals on both sides getting brutalized and murdered and killed, and those are things that I think we're always trying to find solutions. But solution always requires diplomacy.
Republican Vivek Ramaswamy made a surprise appearance. He said to talk with folks at the DNC about immigration and the economy. He also met with Gaza war protesters, but wasn't welcome. Many at the convention say they're ready for Harris to make history as the first mixed-race woman to be president. Sherry Brown is a Black South Carolina delegate who says the issue is deeply personal for her.
White males. Well, I had a high school education, but not a college. I have a master's. They make more money than me. I've observed all throughout men take positions that women were qualified for but did not get.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look at the headlines, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a chance of rain. The overnight low will be 56 degrees. Tomorrow those clouds continue, but it starts to warm up some with a high of 70. Today in history, in 1991, the World Wide Web opens to the public. The information system allows content sharing over the internet in user-friendly ways. It's been central to the development of the information age, and it's the primary tool that billions of people use to interact on the internet. The quote of the day is from English poet William Ernest Henley, born this day in 1849. He wrote, quote, "Who says that we shall pass, or the fame of us fade and die, while the living stars fulfill their round in the living sky."
Indigenous advocates mark 10 years since the death of Tina Fontaine in Canada. Her passing drew international attention to the missing and murdered Indigenous people crisis in Canada. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. This month, many Indigenous people across Canada are marking the 10th anniversary of the death of Tina Fontaine. She disappeared in July of 2014. The 15-year-old's body was found in Winnipeg's Red River. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Fontaine's death threw an international spotlight on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in Canada and led to a national inquiry.
About 100 members of the Sagkeng First Nation, where Fontaine was from, honored her legacy a decade after her death. They marched across their community, 80 miles northeast of Winnipeg, in support of Fontaine's family. And in Winnipeg, the provincial families minister, Nahani Fontaine, said the Manitoba government is honoring Fontaine with an investment of nearly $1 million.
This funding will support operations and programming at Tina's Safe Haven, including counseling support, program mentors, resources, and health care from an Indigenous-led perspective with a focus on relationship building.
Tina's Safe Haven is run by a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping at-risk young people. It's a 24-hour drop-in center for those 13 to 24. The minister also said that Tina's legacy is enormous, and she said we honor her memory in the sacred work we do to protect women, girls, and youth. Nahani Fontaine also said 10 years after her death, the Manitoba government is working to protect Manitobans like her by supporting community partners and programs on the front lines. Of the nearly $1 million, about $400,000 will go to partnering with the Aboriginal Health and Wellness Center for week-long public health nursing. The remainder of the money will go to operating costs and programming. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Nahani Fontaine and Tina Fontaine are not related. In South Dakota, the Bennett County government has agreed to open a satellite voting location to better serve Indigenous communities. This follows claims that the county violated the civil rights of Native Americans by limiting access to polls. Bennett County lies within the boundaries of the Pine Ridge Reservation, though its county seat, the town of Martin, is mostly split demographically between Native American and non-Native residents. The agreement aims to make voting and registration opportunities available to Native voters outside Martin city limits. A memorandum between the U.S. Justice Department and Bennett County says the office will be in the predominantly Native community of Allen, located in the northwest corner of the county. An official with the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewas helping bring Ojibwe to a galaxy far, far away. As Danielle Kading reports, the tribe's language culture coordinator is a voice actor in an Ojibwe dubbing of the first Star Wars film ever made.
The force is with Ngani Animiki Inini Kelvin Hartwig.
I've been a Star Wars fan since I was a kid, so this is checking all the boxes for me.
Hartwig, who lives in Washburn, is the Red Cliff Tribe's language culture coordinator. He lent his voice to the character Red Leader in an Ojibwe dubbing of Star Wars A New Hope. Hartwig says it took about an hour to record around 40 lines for the project in Winnipeg this spring.
And I hope young people and adults alike watch this film and are inspired to either continue learning the Ojibwe language or to start their Ojibwe learning journey.
The film will be screened at select theaters in Wisconsin beginning August 30th. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
And the Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance has announced recipients of the 2024 Indigenous Seedkeeper Stipends. A total of 45 individuals from 36 different tribes have been awarded $2,000 each to support efforts in preserving and cultivating traditional seeds within their communities. The stipends were made possible by Ceres Trust. This is National Native News. Antonia Gonzalez will be back next week. I'm Brian Bull, hosting from KLCC in Eugene, Oregon.
Oregonians will be able to access a new mRNA COVID vaccine in the coming weeks, targeted at the KP2 strain of the virus. That's the one that is most likely to be circulating now, and health officials expect it to ramp up in the fall and winter months. There are two approved vaccines that target this strain of the virus, one from Pfizer and one from Moderna. Health officials stress that the vaccine is a critical part of protecting against a severe strain of the disease. Dr. Dean Seidlinger is the Oregon Health Authority's health officer and state epidemiologist. Dr. Seidlinger said, quote, "I think for people that are on the fence and say, oh, a new FDA vaccine, I'm going to wait, this is the same vaccine that we have been using for the past several years. It is updated to fight some of the more recent variants, but the technology, the proven science behind this vaccine, has been with us for several years," end quote. The health authority does not have an exact date that the COVID KP2 vaccines will be available, but it will be sometime in the next few weeks.
A bill just introduced in Congress would raise public awareness of issues surrounding the end of life, including palliative care and hospice. The Compassionate Care Act would establish guidelines for advanced care planning between health providers and patients. Lisa Paul is a social worker from California who guides families through hospice.
We live in a culture that is very avoidant of conversations on death and dying. And so public education around the importance of planning ahead will improve access so that everyday Americans know to ask for hospice and palliative care.
The bill would direct the government to develop education resources for providers and expand telehealth options. It would also facilitate a study on a national advanced care planning registry that would allow patients to transfer their advance directives from state to state. PAL encourages people to spell out what they want at the end of life so their relatives don't have to make decisions about procedures that could be expensive and painful.
Unless we have these conversations, we won't know. And healthcare providers typically will err on the side of doing it all rather than going with comfort measures.
A similar bill stalled in the House of Representatives in 2020 and never got a vote. More information about end-of-life care is online at compassionandchoices.com.
The city of Eagle, Idaho, has declared itself a non-sanctuary city. Critics say that this could impact the community's most vulnerable, such as people who have survived abuse. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Groups are warning that an Idaho city's decision to declare itself a non-sanctuary city could have far-reaching implications. The repercussions are still being felt from the decision by the city of Eagle, near Boise, in July. Sanctuary cities limit their cooperation with the federal government on immigration laws. The Eagle resolution says that the city will not provide services for people who are undocumented. This could be especially harmful for vulnerable community members, such as those who have experienced domestic violence or sexual abuse. Sarah Sheehan, a clinician with the Women's and Children's Alliance in Boise, says the resolution could prevent people from getting support.
It can create a lot of fear of seeking help from community services in non-sanctuary cities.
Eagle City Council passed the resolution on a consent agenda without public comment. It says the goal of the resolution is maintaining the safety, well-being, and resources of its residents. Critics are urging the council to rescind it. Some states have banned the ability for cities to declare themselves sanctuary cities, such as Florida, but a declaration of non-sanctuary status is rare. However, in February, Mesa County, Colorado, declared itself a non-sanctuary county. Nisha Newton with the Idaho Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence says the harms from this resolution could spread beyond Eagle.
I'm just worried that this decision is going to embolden other discriminatory practices or empower other discriminatory policies throughout the state that we won't necessarily be able to catch up with as service providers and advocates.
Newton says people need to stand up for each other and that this is the wrong tactic if the goal really is to keep people safe.
It requires all of us to build safer communities, and our safety and our wellness doesn't come off the backs of other people being oppressed and other people being denied services.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Biosolid fertilizers, sludge made from human waste, has been used in agriculture for decades and can save farmers and cities money. However, people are becoming increasingly concerned about the forever chemicals, known as PFAS, sometimes found in them. They're hoping for greater federal and state regulations around these substances, as well as better communication about the risk of biosolids. Will Waukee reports.
Concern is growing over PFAS, or forever chemicals, in fertilizers made from human waste. It's called biosolid fertilizer, and it's a billion-dollar industry in the U.S. The substance is often cheaper than other chemicals, and it saves cities money by keeping sewage out of landfills. The problem is, it smells really bad. Sandra Trawick is a donkey farmer in central Oklahoma.
It's something so horrific and so nauseating that it makes your eyes water. It gives you an instant headache. Some people just instantly throw up. It's next level horrible.
Trawick's also concerned about the chemicals sometimes found in biosolids, which have been shown to harm the environment and human health. Advocates are pushing for greater federal and state regulations around these substances. They also want more communication with farmers about the potential dangers of biosolids. More than 80% of Oklahoma's wastewater sludge ends up in crop fields. While fertilizer companies and farmers who use the sludge say they've been following regulations for years, Trawick says the issue is getting worse and governments are not keeping up. That's because of chemicals going down people's drains that don't degrade easily in the environment. PFAS are commonly found in medications, industrial waste, personal hygiene products, and other substances.
Why is this not front page news? Why hasn't every farmer gotten a letter stating you should not be taking biosolids because it is bioaccumulative, it builds up in the soil, it builds up in the water, and your farm could be deemed contaminated?
Groups have already sued the Environmental Protection Agency over a lack of PFAS standards in sewage sludge. The EPA is still studying how much the substance impacts drinking water and human health. The story was produced with original reporting from Ben Felder for Investigate Midwest. I'm Milwaukee, Oklahoma News Service.
An invasive insect that threatens hemlock trees could accelerate the release of climate pollution from forests. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As climate change has caused warmer winters, an invasive insect called the hemlock woolly adelgid has spread across forests in the eastern U.S., killing hemlock trees from Maine to Alabama. And scientists are worried that this insect spread could also accelerate climate change. Hemlocks, like other trees, absorb planet-warming carbon from the atmosphere as they grow. Danielle Ignace of the University of British Columbia explains that when hemlock needles fall, the carbon they contain is stored in the soil for a long time.
These needles, they're hard to decompose. They don't break down very easily, but they really build this strong, deep, and really full soil organic layer. So that has a great potential to store carbon.
But when the woolly adelgid kills a hemlock, that evergreen tree is often replaced by a deciduous tree like black birch. And black birch leaves decompose much faster than hemlock needles.
Those leaves are much easier to break down,
which releases carbon back to the atmosphere more quickly. So as the woolly adelgid spreads, eastern forests may store less carbon underground, which could make global warming worse. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.